wanted to know more. And, you know, who did they, you know, speak to about this issue? The greatest enemy of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. But anyway, the emperor was very astute. He was very clever in terms of how he paraphrased his questions to him. And he said to him, he says, what is the quality of this man, this Prophet Muhammad? And he says, what kind of people follow him? Who follows him in Arabia? And he says, the poor and the slaves. And that's where you took me when you mentioned that exact point, that this is one of the qualities of the awliya. This is one of the qualities of the holy prophets, that they carry the common man. And this is very, very important, because we spoke in contrast about the fact that how the elites don't trust the people and hate the people. And this is why they're becoming police states, aren't they? I mean, this is why the US is going to use drones now on their own population. So this is the sort of thing. But to carry on with our discussion, please take it to the next level, because we are really talking about, you know, we talked about the opinion of the expert opinion of Rahbar. We talked about the supreme leader. But I think you're now going to quote some other experts now on their view of of this great personality.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I promised to quote two things from the supreme leader last program. Only got to one of them.
Oh, did you? Right, okay.
So the one thing that I quoted was from a speech that was, you know, in the past.
That's right. Yes.
Right. And he basically talked about how, you know, Imam was really somebody on the level of, you know, or close to the level of the prophets and the awliya in terms impact on the world.
Sure.
And the second thing I wanted to quote, again, from the supreme leader, talking about how Imam was and, you know, the beauty of just seeing that person and the way they lived and the way the example that they were, and the fact that he combined this deep piety and complete submission, as you were speaking about in the previous program, to God, being a complete, you know, servant of God, and at the same time leading humans and leading societies and confronting, you know, the most powerful of the oppressors and of the dhalimeen, as is
the famous quote that was given in most UK papers. They translated it from the Farsi, Butt Chicken. Thank you very much for that. But the idol smasher of our time. And you saw a picture
of
the Statue of Liberty it's very communism being broken up and stuff like that.
It's very interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, I'm going to get to this
idea
of Butt Chicken later,
yeah,
because that's also a very important thing for many people. That was, you know. But the quote that the Supreme Leader, this is the one from the Supreme Leader talking about Imam, the one that he recently made, which is a combination of Imam being both a deeply pious and spiritual person in his personal life, and also at the same time being a leader of peoples, which is something that in the Western view, in the modern view, is, you know, separate. You are either a monk in your, you know, separate in your desert, you know, retreat, or whereas Imam completely broke that.
Sure.
He was, just as he was spiritual, he was also a leader of humanity, which is what Islam tells us. This is what the Prophet did.
Sure.
This is what the Imam did.
We are going to listen to that quote now.
کسی مثل امام بزرگوار ما که یک تنه وارد شد.
Somebody like our magnanimous Imam, who single-handedly entered the arena, managed to unite all the people and launch this great movement with his firm determination, faith, and reliance on God, relied more than anything else on knowledge and understanding, on worship of God, and on the enthusiasm which originates from one's heart and soul. Until the end of his life, this great person used to wake up in the middle of the night and shed tears despite being old and physically weak.
با وجود پیری و ناتوانی و شکستگی نیمه شب بر میخواست اشک میریخت. ما خبر داشتیم از نزدیکان ایشان که
We knew it because we had heard from his close relatives, who knew everything about his lifestyle, that he used to wake up in the middle of the night and ask Allah, the Exalted, for help. He used to keep a vigil at night. He was like this at night, and during the day, he used to enter the arena like a roaring lion and defeat global powers and solve the people's problems. He used to strengthen and set in motion the determination of all the people, thanks to his reliance on spirituality.
همه ما مردم رو تقویت میکرد و راه میانداخت به برکت اون پشتوانه معنوی.
Very, very powerful words there from the Supreme Leader about this great personality of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul. Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I mean, what can we say after that? I mean, the thing is that he certainly, you know, put it in a nutshell, you know, that this is a man truly of God, and he enters the arena in order to guide mankind against the most powerful demonic forces that were there at the time.
Right, and I mean, this is the thing that we were talking about, which is that, you know, this was completely, had been lost in humanity.
It
the fact
been,
that
yeah.
you could be somebody who was deeply spiritual.
Deeply spiritual, yes.
And, you know, devoted in your personal life and in your worship, you know, on a daily basis in the middle of the night, you know, wherever it was that you had to be connected to God, and at the same time be somebody who is, you know, completely active and leads a nation towards its liberation and towards
independence,
you know, its
yes.
independence, its awakening. Mm. It's and you know, these are things that, you know, over the years, when you look at how Western civilization developed, how
sure.
you know, religion was put aside, how you had this idea of, you know,
that materialism was the way to go.
Right. And again, this has to do also with Christianity itself.
That's
the
true.
Fact that it failed in many, many ways.
Of course it is.
In order to really satisfy the needs of humanity. And this is why we say that Islam is the deen al-haq, is the religion of truth.
Truth, yes.
Is the one that's the most updated version for humanity.
Exactly.
The one that actually, you know, is able to satisfy all the needs of humanity. This is why we're Muslim. Because
exactly.
we say Islam is a complete religion.
Mm.
And again, I want to emphasize these things. These things, we've talked about this before, but it's always good to remind
yeah,
ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of these things.
I mean, I think
you
it's
know,
worth
there's
mentioning.
No point in having a God that doesn't care about people. There's no point in having a God that doesn't care about social justice. There's no point in having a God that doesn't care about the liberation and the liberty of human beings.
Sure.
There's no point in having a God that allies himself with the oppressors.
No.
Okay?
No.
So I'm saying these things in a strong way because we have this very...
And I thank you for it.
Mm. Odd image of, like, you know...
Mm. But that was the image that was given, being
right.
given to
I
us.
I mean, the idea that, you know, God, you know, he's the one that's... He's the main thing.
Mm.
You know, he's not going to forget about the people who are poor and deprived. And, you know, like you mentioned very nicely, the fact that you always had the prophets... You know, and of course, at the best example of it being Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, being, you know, with the poor and the slaves. And we have the same thing with, you know, Prophet Ibrahim. We have the same thing with Prophet Musa.
Absolutely.
You know,
Moses,
with Prophet
yes.
Isa, peace
yes.
be upon them all.
Sure.
You know, you look at, and it's even in the Bible. It's in the Torah.
Yes,
you know,
is,
these are not things
is.
That, you know, but also in our, you know, in the Quranic version of their stories, you know, the people that follow them are not the elites initially.
No.
Because they are a threat to the, you know, money, wealth, and power, and of these elites. The fact
well,
that these
I mean,
elites would
I,
be
I,
above
I,
the law.
If I could make a quote from the media, which I heard recently, and it's a quite a funny quote, facetious quote, but it's interesting. We believe in the prophets as the 124,000 that came into this world as Muslims, but the elites believe in these prophets, which is just.
You know, with F.
With F.
As opposed to PH.
PH, exactly.
Exactly. So this is the point, you know. And like the Supreme Leader was mentioning, here's a man, you know, even in old age, even at a time when he was physically...
Yes, as the Supreme Leader was
you know,
saying,
when he was physically, you know, ill and, you know,
getting
up in the middle of the night, beseeching...
Beseeching, yes, that's the word, yes.
You know,
yes.
Beseeching at night and besieging the enemies at, in the...
Yes, besiege, because he did mention that.
And creating
because,
the besiege.
Yeah. And he created the besiege, yes. The volunteer
so,
defense
so,
force.
So, you know,
right.
these are the things that... this is why people followed him. This is
of
why.
Course they did.
This is why we always look at him and think of him as the most important person spiritually that we were able to, you know...
I think
have in our life.
I think this is a point to be mentioned here that ishq that the Supreme Leader referred to in his description,
the love
of the this love, and I think that's the essence of religion. That's what it's all about. It's
exactly.
about that love, and I think we had a taste of that while, you know,
exactly.
we were living those times, and it was that love that was the greatest motivator in terms of that liberation that we now experience today.
There is no doubt in our minds after having witnessed Imam and the things that happened with him and during his time, you know, because we're talking about Imam and his times, right? This is the program. There's no doubt in our minds about the existence of God. There's no doubt in our mind about, you know, the truthfulness and the rightfulness of the Sunnah of the Prophet, peace be upon him, about the school of Ahlul Bayt, because we experienced it. This was not, it wasn't theoretical. It wasn't something that we were taught and to memorize only.
Yeah.
It was something that we experienced on a daily basis in our lives, and the things that happened and the challenges that we were able to overcome.
It was from the heart.
And, you know, it was practical. It was real. It was not, you know, something distant that, you know, you had to, you know, go through many different twists and turns and able to understand it. It was something we experienced on a daily basis. Yeah. We felt it. We saw it. We knew it. Mm. And this is the difference between Islamic spirituality and maybe others, which is that, and this is an important point.
Please.
You know, and I hope, you know, just to bear with me and the listeners that, you know, this might seem like a deeper academic point, but this is actually very important, which is in Islamic philosophy, in Islamic spirituality, Irfan, as the only school that has reached this level in terms of explaining it, we claim, or the school of Ahlul Bayt claims in its Irfan, that there at some point there is a unity between the person who knows and the knowledge that he has. This is different than in other schools of philosophy and in other schools of spirituality.
I see.
You know, you have that spiritual aspect in other religions, but it is not explained well. It is not understood well in as a academic matter.
I see.
Spirituality is equated with emotionalism.
That's right.
Which is not true. You know, this is not the reality of it. When we talk about reaching the highest levels of spirituality, it is an actually where there's very little emotion. It's pure logic. It's pure having a 100% knowledge and understanding of something.
A kind of certitude.
It's a certitude, exactly. A very firm certitude where you as the knower and the knowledge are combined. This is when we talk about the knowledge of the prophets or the imams. This is the kind of knowledge that we're talking about.
Sure.
Okay, this is what makes them different from normal humans.
In Arabic, we call it yaqeen, isn't it?
It's yaqeen. Mm-hmm. And you know, in philosophy, they call it ilm huduri, which is presence knowledge.
Yes, I've heard of this.
It's presence knowledge.
Presence knowledge.
As opposed to knowledge, which is the normal kind of knowledge that we have, which is you as the knower are separate from the knowledge.
Mm.
You have the knowledge, but it's separate. There's not a unity.
But this is like a living knowledge. You're actually living it.
So what we felt and what we saw and what we experienced, as an example, I'm saying. When we say we, I mean those of us who lived that time.
That's right. Absolutely.
Those of us who saw it, of us who experienced it, you know. These are things that there is such a level of certainty for us in this. It's beyond the things that we normally talk about and the normal levels of existence that you know, we experience. Again, something acknowledged by, you know, non-Muslims, even enemies of Islam, even enemies of Imam.
Sure.
These are things that have to do with, you know, when you see it, there's no denying it.
Mm.
You know, there's many examples of, you know, Western statesmen, politicians, journalists, elites.
Yeah, who have some kind of charisma.
Right, who then saw what happened with Imam and acknowledged that this was different.
This was different, yes.
Than what they had experienced previously.
Previously, yes.
Okay, this has to do with what you mentioned, which is, you know, the idol smasher.
That's right.
Butchikan, you know, we always used to, there was this, I remember now that, you know, they used to have the chant when he would come in, which is, you know, you are our soul, you are, you know, the idol smasher.
The idol smasher.
And, you know, when, as you correctly point out, you know, those idols were the idols that related to things like, you know, having to become Western or having to become Eastern, even for those who were Marxist or communist or who wanted to join the Soviets. You know, sphere.
Yeah.
That's on one level. Yes. And of course, on a deeper level, it has to do with your own inside and your own spiritual, you know, the Jihad Akbar, you know, the greater jihad.
The greater jihad, yes.
Which, of course, is also, you know, one of his famous speeches that he held. Mm. And it's a book. It's been translated into English. It's very good. He's actually talking to the seminary students. He's talking about that, you know, the main thing in life is to have that inner greater jihad of yourself, fighting against yourself.
The nafs, the jihad.
The animal levels of your own existence.
Sure.
It's also the first hadith that he quotes in his 40 hadith, in his famous...
That's right, yes.
Starts off with 40 hadith, with the hadith where, you know, some of the companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, they returned from war, from battle, jihad askar, smaller jihad.
Smaller jihad.
And he says, you know, good for you that you went and good that you fought in the jihad askar, but now it's time to do jihad akbar. And they go, what is jihad akbar? Mm. And he says... I'm sorry, quoting, you know, you're the hadith.
No, expert. That's all right. No, please. No, this is your platform.
He says
today.
Jihad al-Akbar is jihad al-Nafs. Is fighting your inner
self.
Yes. So
your inner ego. Yeah.
So, you know, this is the thing about Imam. I want to quote here because I mentioned that even his enemies or those who have nothing to do with Islam.
Yes, you were going to.
And none other. Our good friend and, you know, Henry Kissinger.
Henry Kissinger, yes. We always go back to
him. Mention him. Yeah. And I'm paraphrasing again because it's a longer quote. I don't want to take up too much time. He talks about the fact that, and he calls him Ayatollah Khomeini.
Does he?
Very good. At least he knew that, you know.
Of course. Yes. I think he was one of the more smarter men.
Right.
Of course he is.
He says that Ayatollah Khomeini, in a serious way, created a crisis for the planners of the West. Because his decisions were so thunderous, were so shaking.
Earth-shaking. Yeah.
So based on, based on things that they had no clue about, that he says, Henry Kissinger says, that we didn't know what to do.
Exactly.
We didn't know what to do.
Well, this is a very good... Because could I just come here briefly, just for a couple of seconds? Because there was a... this was from George Shultz, I remember. He was Secretary of State at the time in the Reagan administration. And they said this. This is a quote direct from him, where he said, we had weekly meetings or almost daily meetings about the situation in Iran.
Right.
And he says, everybody was called in. All the big,
experts and,
you know, military people and,
strategic people
who knew something about Iran, really knew something about Iran. They all sat them together. Reagan then asks the question, you know, what about Ayatollah Khomeini? And he says the room was silent.
That's so funny.
He says nobody could come up with anything. And, you know, what you're quoting there is true because, you know, there were meetings in the White House where they just simply did not know what to do. And then eventually Reagan came up with the idea that why don't we send a cake and a couple of pistols to Rafsanjani, you know, the president of Rafsanjani at the time, you know. And this is the thing. And he sent a Bible. That's right. He sent a signed Bible because he did have some kind of religious background, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
But he sent, with his autograph, a Bible, you know, a signed Bible. So, you know, this shows you that, you know, the only thing that was left to them was to respond in religion. They couldn't do anything from the political point of view.
Yeah. So he talks about how these... you know, earth-shaking decisions.
Yes, absolutely.
By the Imam left them, you know,
completely
in disarray, not knowing what to do. He says nobody knew what to do with these decisions that were made, and that basically Henry Kissinger.
Henry Kissinger was because
Ayatollah Khomeini, as he says, was conducting his affairs, his confrontation with the West based on divine precepts. Okay?
Divine precepts. And teachings.
This was the thing that we didn't know what to do about because they had never confronted anybody like that. Okay? And so he said that not only was he confronting us based on these divine teachings and precepts, but he was completely sincere in his in his enmity.
And that was the real problem.
He was very sincere in his enmity. We couldn't buy him off.
We couldn't
scare him. We couldn't do any of that stuff. You know, this is Henry Kissinger, and I just want to mention two events which really prove this.
Please.
Because again, we're going back and talking about, you know, the Supreme Leader mentioned how at night he would, you know, seek the help and guidance and grace from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And in the day, he would enter the arena like a roaring lion.
It's fantastic.
You know? Now, let's talk about some of these examples
please.
Roaring lion.
Roaring lion, yes.
You know, and also related to what, you know, Henry Kissinger was talking about here, which is that you had at the beginning of the revolution, basically it was time to, the Shah had left and there was the Bakhtiar government, which was, you know, appointed by the Shah.
By the Shah, that's right.
But the Shah had left, and this was going to be, you know, the new way of ruling Iran, which is, you know, the Shah is, you know, only nominal. And
according to standard CIA procedure.
Right, exactly. Right. We have this kind of nationalist type leader who had his, you know, history of confronting the Shah, but still a constitutional monarchy, and Iran staying within the Western sphere. And but instead of having the Shah and his prime ministers having this kind of nationalist leader there. And so Imam at that time is in Paris, and they say to him, well, you know, you got what you wanted. The Shah has left. You know, isn't this what you wanted? Why deal with politics? Go back and, you know, just be the spiritual person that you are, and you're
that.
Praying. And, you know, you can go to Qom. You can go sit there in Qom and,
that's
you know, make your pronouncements
and
your proclamations.
And
you can even, you are even allowed to mention things, you know, in the newspapers and on TV if you feel something's going wrong somewhere. But let this, you know, westernized... these guys that are, you know, nationalists, let them rule just be happy with what you've reached.
What was the response?
So not only that, this was
that,
more
that
than
was
that.
One aspect, right.
So this was the general thing that they told him.
Okay.
Which, of course, he said, we don't even accept this new government.
Yes, that's right.
This is an appointed government by a king who didn't have any legal basis himself.
So this
government has no legal basis. We're going to have our own government. Okay. So this is the situation. We're talking about somebody, the courage, you know, roaring lion.
Yes, roaring lion.
Okay.
Yes. So this is one of the things we loved about him.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's a man. He's gotten rid of the Shah, who's officially has left the country.
Yes.
He's in Paris. Everybody's, you know, saying, look, you know, you got what you wanted. You know, okay.
Shah left.
You know, it's finished.
It's finished.
And just let these guys do it. They know what they're doing. Yeah. You know, a country needs these elites to run them. We can't have, you know, mullahs running things. You guys don't know what to do. You know, these guys are all Sorbonne and, you know, Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard educated.
Sure.
You know, let them just do what they have to do.
Sure.
And they're not monarchists, you know, in that sense. You know, they don't. Imam said, no way. We're not having any of that. Then this is quoted, what I'm saying now, by one of the leaders of the national religious parties that at that time was working with Imam, which then later left the revolution.
right.
And he's quoting this. I'm not going to mention his name because, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yes,
he was a high up member of the national religious movement in Iran at that time.
Sure.
What I'm saying, he quoted in the BBC. So this is not something that we've made up somewhere. We heard this is him saying this in the BBC.
Sure.
I heard it from him quoting it in a documentary in the BBC. He says that through me, because this person had lived in the States before and, you know, spoke English and, you know, had spent his exile time in the US. So the Americans felt that he's a person that they can talk to. And he had a connection with Imam. This man, he's saying that the Americans told me to tell Imam that Imam should accept the Bakhtiar government. The way that I explained it now. You can go live in Rome and do your thing. But accept this government.
Sure.
And if you don't, we will tell the military to make a coup d'etat and arrest all of you.
Ah.
You know, the usual American, you know, like what they did in Indonesia and Chile and whatever.
Yes. And,
And if you don't accept it and if you cause trouble, we will tell the military to make a coup d'etat.
Yeah.
And we have the list of all the people that need to be arrested, you know, the 500, 1,000 to be, and we will execute all of you.
Okay.
So this is a threat.
Right, yes.
Thruffer.
Yes, right? The Thruffer game. Yes. We're back to that again.
Threat
and
offer. You
threat
know?
And offer, yes.
So what does Imam say?
But yes.
Imam says to this man, says, tell the Americans, if you do this, I will declare jihad. I will issue a fatwa of jihad.
MashaAllah.
And we will take over the whole country and we will destroy the army.
Excellent.
Okay. Roaring lion.
Roaring lion.
Right?
I mean, he was extremely
So
courageous.
This person
There's
that's
no
explaining
doubt about that.
This... on BBC, you can just tell he's like frustrated. Like, why would Imam do such a thing? Like, He's like, why would you do
that? Well, he believes in the Quran, my friend.
Right.
And he believes in God.
So this is the first example of Roaring Lion and the things that Henry Kissinger is talking about. The fact that
This is what
if the Americans in history had this, what they did, this proffer, this threat offer, had, you know, if you look back at history 50 years, it always worked.
Will always work.
And if it didn't, you know, they would have, okay, so... The Americans like, okay, fine. So you're going to go challenge us. We'll see what happens. Because remember that after the revolution, we had many coup attempts.
Of course.
By the army, supported by the Americans.
Yes, of course. And you know, there were many martyrs as well, of course.
So the threat didn't work. Mm. Imam came to Iran. Mm. He made that famous speech where he said, I'm going to punch this government into the mouth when he talked about the Bakhtiar government.
That's right, yes.
And we will establish our own government.
With the help of the people. That's right.
So, Roaring Lion.
Roaring Lion. Right?
America threatens him. Hmm. The military in Iran is threatening him. He stands up. He goes to the – he gets off the plane. He goes to the grave of the martyrs in Beisht Zahra, which is where all the martyrs
are. That's right. Yes, yes.
And
that's
in front of the martyrs and the graves of the martyrs, says to everybody, we will – punch this government into the mouth, and we will establish our own government.
I think that's a good point.
Part two of the story and the next.
It's a good point to stop. Because punching in the mouth is the right way to go with the kind of tyranny we face at the moment in this century as well, because there's a lot to learn from Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. Thanks very much for listening today. It leaves me only to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dr. Mahdi Darabi, thanks very much for your contribution once again. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Syria. The successes of the Syrian army and its allies at the end of 2014 gave the Syrian people hope in finding a solution to the crisis. But the hope did not last long because in the early months of 2015, the situation changed in favor of the opposition. In March 2015, Jaish al-Fatah announced its formation. Jaish al-Fatah was formed when a number of extremist Salafi groups like the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham united. As a first step, Jaish al-Fatah attacked the city of Idlib and was able to take full control of it in a short time. Idlib is the provincial capital of the province of Idlib in northwestern Syria. It borders Turkey, and its proximity to the coastal provinces gives it a strategic position. Jaish al-Fatah continued its advances in Idlib province, and after a short time, it conquered the city of Jisr al-Shughur. With the fall of Jisr al-Shughur, the cities of Fo'a and Kafaria faced a critical situation. Fo'a and Kafaria are two Shia-dominated cities in Idlib province, which were completely besieged by Jaish al-Fatah. The residents of Fo'a and Kafaria knew that if the cities fell, Nusra Front forces would massacre everyone. That's why they resisted tooth and nail. When there was no way of delivering aid to these cities, Iranian military transport planes took over the responsibility of sending aid to the cities so that the people could resist for a longer time. The rapid withdrawal of the Syrian army from Idlib province showed that the Syrian army was incapable of confronting the forces of Jaish al-Fatah. Because Idlib shares a border with Turkey, Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham were well backed by Turkey, and this made taking back these regions difficult. this stage, the advances of Jaish al-Fatah toward Aleppo or the coastal provinces had to be stopped. For this reason, on the order of General Soleimani, a new phase of organizing forces under Iranian command began. Initially, the involvement of the Iranian Air Force in Syria was raised, but General Soleimani did not consider it suitable. So the Iranians decided to persuade Russia to send its air force to Syria. The Russians had a strong interest in maintaining the government of Bashar Assad because Syria had long been Russia's strategic base in the Middle East. Aside from that, the large number of Chechen forces among Salafi armed groups in Syria had made confronting them one of Russia's national security priorities.
If you go to Moscow, and I do, and you go and see the Kremlin, you look over the Kremlin wall, due south, you see Chechnya, which Putin is still very worried about as a seat of Islamic revolution, you see. And Putin, if you keep on looking beyond Chechnya, you see the minarets of Damascus.
General Qasem Soleimani recently visited Moscow to meet with senior Russian leaders.
At the time, some news agencies reported that General Soleimani had met with Putin, a meeting which was aimed at convincing Putin of military intervention in Syria. Participation of the Russian Air Force, the Iranians also increased the size of their forces in Syria. The new forces that had come from Iran were no longer just advisors, but were organized in the form of combat forces. The IRGC now commanded a front consisting of multinational ground forces and was supported by the Russian Air Force. This powerful combination could change the balance of power on the battlefield in favor of the Syrian government, and it was natural that it would lead to the opposition of countries that supported the armed opposition. Turkey was angrier than any other country at the presence of the Russian Air Force. Its President Erdogan knew that the presence of Iranian forces and Russian air support could make things difficult for the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham. But this was not the only problem Turkey had. On October the 10th, 2015, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces announced their formation in the city of Hasaka. The main structure of these forces was the Kurdish defenders of the city of Kobani. They had previously been supported by the Syrian army and the IRGC in the fight against Daesh, but now they had gotten closer to the Americans. Because these forces were openly supported by the U.S. and the Syrian government did not want to directly engage the U.S., it avoided taking a clear stance against them. The priority of the Syrian army at this time was to eliminate the Takfiri groups. But the formation of these forces angered Turkey. A large part of the Syrian Democratic Forces was made up of fighters from the PKK, which Turkey had designated as a terrorist group. Now, the Americans were strengthening them along the borders of Turkey, and this was not acceptable to the Turkish government. All of this had exacerbated Erdogan's stance against the US and Russia. On November the 24th, 2015, a Russian Air Force Sukhoi 24 aircraft was shot down by a Turkish plane in the north of Syria. Turkey's prime minister announced that the aircraft had ignored warnings and entered Turkish soil for 17 seconds. The two pilots of the aircraft ejected. One of them was found by Russian patrols, but the other one was killed by Nusra Front forces.
Vladimir Putin explicitly stated that the incidents would not go unanswered and demanded an official apology from the Turks. On the other side, Erdogan not only did not apologize, but also warned that it would be better for Russia not to play with fire. Erdogan was almost certain that in the event of a Russian response, NATO forces would intervene in support of the Turkish army. But instead of a military response, Putin imposed a series of economic sanctions on Turkey. He banned the import of fruits and vegetables from Turkey and stopped the export of gas to the country. On the other hand, he also banned Russian citizens from traveling to Turkey. The sanctions were a severe blow to Turkey's economy, as the country hosted about 4 million Russian tourists a year and imported half of its gas from Russia. All of these pressures prompted Erdogan to formally apologize to Russia, contrary to his pledges, and to announce that he was ready to pay damages for the plane crash and compensate the killing of its pilot. At the same time, the UN Secretary General's envoy called on the influential countries involved in the crisis in Syria to gather in Vienna to find a political solution to the conflict. Although such meetings had been fruitless in the past, the Vienna conference had undergone several changes which may have made a difference. The first feature was the presence of Iran. Until then, because of Iran's insistence on the continued rule of Bashar Assad, the Americans had prevented Iran from being invited to such meetings. But now, after the JCPOA had been signed, the U.S. sought to persuade Iran to change its regional positions. For that reason, it did not object to Iran's invitation to the conference. Even though Syrian opposition groups stated that they will boycott the summit if Iran attended, the UN had not invited any of them to the meeting to begin with. The second feature of the conference was that it coincided with Daesh operations in European cities. A few days before the summit, Paris witnessed a series of unprecedented terrorist operations which Daesh claimed responsibility for. This meant that European countries had more incentives in finding a political solution and ending the crisis in Syria. Therefore, there were possibilities that they may give up some of their strong positions against Bashar Assad. Although the Vienna conference was held with these assumptions, once again the countries influential in the Syrian crisis could not reach a practical agreement. The most important difference, as in the past, were the fate of the legitimate government of Syria and how to deal with terrorist groups. A few days after the Vienna meeting, the Syrian army announced that it had targeted Zahran Alush on the outskirts of Damascus with the cooperation of the Russian Air Force. Zahran Alush was the leader of Jaish al-Islam, which had control of the Ghouta region in the suburbs of Damascus. He was an influential figure among the armed opposition who was openly supported by Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis were trying to convince the international community that he and his group, Jaish al-Islam, were a moderate opposition force. The proximity of the Ghouta region to Damascus and its geological complexity had always been a serious threat to the security of the capital. Therefore, weakening Jaish al-Islam was one of the main priorities of the Syrian army and its allies. Even though Jaish al-Islam immediately announced its new commander, Saudi Arabia knew that it could not easily find a person with the abilities of Zahran Alush. With the death of Alush, the hundreds of millions of dollars spent to strengthen him were practically lost. But Saudi Arabia was reluctant to accept this fact and instead tried to escalate tensions with Iran even higher. A few days after the death of Zahran Alush, Saudi Arabia executed Shia cleric Sheikh Nimran Nimr, who was a critic of the Saudi government. As it was anticipated, the execution of Sheikh Nimr caused the anger of Shias across the world. A group of Iranians gathered in front of the Saudi embassy in Tehran and the Saudi consulate in Mashhad. Their protest gradually escalated into violence, and Iranian police were unable to prevent protesters from entering the Saudi embassy building. The protesters set fire to parts of the Saudi embassy and destroyed its property. Iran announced that it had arrested the protesters and formally condemned their actions. But Saudi Arabia recalled its diplomats from Iran due to insecurity, and diplomatic relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia were completely severed. Some other Arab countries also withdrew their diplomats from Iran in support of Saudi Arabia. As these events were going on, Haj Qasem Soleimani was busy planning the complete liberation of the city. On the other hand, Turkey would under no conditions allow Aleppo to come under the control of the Syrian government. Under these circumstances, the IRGC's Quds force carried out the first phase of the operation to liberate Aleppo in the southwest of the city. During this operation, which was named Nasr, Iranian-led forces were able to retake the strategic city of Khan Tuman from the Jaish al-Fatah and approach the main Aleppo-Hama road. But the beginning of a harsh winter and the arrival of large numbers of troops and weapons from Turkey for Jaish al-Islam forced Iranian-led forces to retreat from Khan Tuman after a while. But Haj Qasem Soleimani immediately implemented the second phase of the operation, this time in eastern Aleppo. In this phase, Iranian-led forces attempted to bypass eastern Aleppo. This operation was carried out on a route that was controlled by Nusra Front on the one end and Daesh on the other. For this reason, everyone thought success would be out of the question. But despite these complexities, Iranian-led forces advanced rapidly and reached Nubl and Az-Zahra in northern Aleppo. With the success of this phase of the operation, Shias living in Nubl and Az-Zahra were liberated from a 3.5-year siege. Now, the city of Aleppo was under siege from the east as well, and this was a great step towards its complete liberation. As the Syrian army and its allies prepared for the great war in Aleppo, armed Salafi groups began to strengthen their positions inside the city. But this strengthening of positions was not limited to military activities.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.
In July 2016, Abu Muhammad Julani sent out a video message announcing that the Nusra Front had been disbanded as an Al-Qaeda-linked group and had been replaced by a new group with no ties to groups outside Syria. The announcement of the severance of ties with Al-Qaeda meant that Fatah al-Sham was supposed to only operate in Syria and did not seek operations around the world like Al-Qaeda. Therefore, it should not be recognized as a terrorist group by the international community. The first reactions to this were made by the Free Army. The Free Army, which identified itself as secular, welcomed the renaming of Nusra, calling them the Sons of the Syrian Nation. Differences emerged within the structure of the Nusra Front. It was reported that some figures close to Al-Qaeda had decided to leave the movement and wanted to launch a new movement that would remain linked to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda reacted to stop the disintegration of Nusra. In an effort to silence protesters, Ahmad Abulkhair, the deputy of Ayman al-Zawahiri, announced in an audio message that the renaming of the Nusra Front had been carried out with the coordination and consent of al-Qaeda. All these events caused Western countries to turn away from these changes, and Jolani's decision to change the name of the Nusra Front was practically useless. The U.S. explicitly stated that the change would not cause the removal of the group from the list of terrorists. As these events unfolded, Lebanon's Hezbollah held a military parade in the city of Qusair to prepare its forces for the Aleppo War. The parade was characterized by the large presence of armored and heavy weapons, something that did not exist before in Hezbollah's combat structure, which was mainly a resistance group. With the parade, Hezbollah showed that the experience of fighting extremist groups in Syria had turned the movement into a full-fledged army. In these circumstances, Haj Qasem Soleimani ordered the beginning of the Aleppo operation. The first phase of the operation was to complete the siege of the eastern part of Aleppo, which was inhabited by armed Salafi groups. At the time, the only connection path of the armed opposition groups was the Castello route in the north of the city. The Castello route connects the eastern region of Aleppo to Idlib province and the Turkish border. The Syrian army announced several safe routes before the operation began so that the residents of eastern Aleppo could leave the area. Some residents used the opportunity and left the militant-held area. They settled in camps set up by the IRGC in the Sheikh Najjar area. At 0 hour of the operation, the Syrian army and its allies launched an offensive to liberate Castello Route. The attack was supported by the Russian Air Force. The armed opposition knew that the loss of Castello Route could bring them closer to losing the entire city of Aleppo. That's why they came to the battlefield with all their might. But despite all their efforts, the Syrian army and forces under Iranian command liberated Castello Route, and the eastern region of Aleppo was completely besieged. With the completion of the siege of Aleppo, the second phase of the operation began. The purpose of this phase was to liberate the northern neighborhoods and tighten the siege. Before the start of this phase, the people living in the east of Aleppo were once again given the opportunity to leave the city. The Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham, which were planning a major operation aimed at breaking the siege of Aleppo, repeatedly promised the people that the siege of the city would be broken soon. Based on these promises, some of the remaining people in the city, who were ideologically close to the armed groups, refused to leave Aleppo. At the same time, political and media pressures intensified to prevent the complete liberation of Aleppo. Western media outlets regularly reported from inside Aleppo, in which the residents were asking for help.
It's the last of these.
The presence of foreign members of al-Qaeda on well-known international media outlets had turned into an ordinary event and asking for help from the people.
It's the last time that I talk to you.
People are executed. It's as simple as that.
Turkey and Germany plan to seek...
On the other hand, Turkey and some European countries called for NATO intervention to prevent the liberation of Aleppo.
Speaking after meeting Angela Merkel in Ankara, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet...
Even the UN Security Council sought to pass a resolution for international intervention in Aleppo, which was vetoed by Russia.
In short, it is difficult to deny that Russia is partnering with the Syrian regime to carry out war crimes.
What Russia is sponsoring and doing is not counterterrorism, it is barbarism.
Thanks to this international support, Jaish al-Fatah moved from Idlib province to the southwest of Aleppo with all its might. Their goal was to break the siege of the eastern part. In a fierce battle, Jaish al-Fatah succeeded in breaking the siege of the eastern part of the city by occupying the Ramusa district and the military academy. Now they had to maintain the area so that the process of sending equipment to the forces present in eastern Aleppo could continue. On the other side of the battle, the Syrian army and its allies had to liberate the Ramusa district any way they could. Because without besieging the eastern part, there was no way to completely liberate the city. But this was very difficult because the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham had stationed large numbers of troops and equipment in the area. General Soleimani put Iranian forces in charge of liberating these areas, and heavy battles between the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham began in Ramusa. This fierce battle lasted for 40 days, but eventually extremist Salafi groups retreated with very high casualties, and once again the siege of the eastern part was completed. With the completion of the siege of the city, the process of liberating the eastern part began neighborhood by neighborhood. At this point, the residents of the city were once again given the opportunity to leave. These residents were mostly family members of armed opposition groups. They themselves were now sure that they could not resist any longer. That's why they sent their families to Idlib on buses provided by the Syrian government. After the families left, the process of liberating the city accelerated and the neighborhoods were liberated one after another. Things got to the point where several thousand gunmen stationed in the city gathered in one neighborhood. They then sought the help of Turkey to create a situation for their safe exit from the city. Erdogan agreed with Putin that the militants hand over their heavy weapons to be allowed to leave Aleppo and go to Idlib. But the agreement between Turkey and Russia was unacceptable to Iran. At the time, thousands of Shias living in Foa and Kafaria were besieged by Jaish al-Fatah for a long time. And if the armed forces were allowed to leave, in return, a part of the residents of Foa and Kafaria had to be released from the siege. In Iran's opinion, Russia's action was a gift to the armed opposition without getting anything back in return. The day after the Turkish-Russian agreement was announced, the first group of militants, who were 1,250 in number, left Aleppo. But General Soleimani ordered the remaining militants to be prevented from leaving, and the Russian-Turkish agreement was effectively annulled. Under General Soleimani's leadership, the Iranians directly contacted Ahrar al-Sham officials who were following the issue of the withdrawal of the militants in order to facilitate the exchange of the residents of Foa and Kafaria with the militants of Aleppo. This was the first direct contact between Iranian forces and extremist Salafi groups. In the end, it was agreed that in exchange for the militants in Aleppo, 3,000 Shia residents of Foa and Kafaria were liberated from the siege. With the exit of all militants from Aleppo, the city was totally liberated from occupation after 5 years. analysts deemed the complete liberation of Aleppo as a sign of the beginning to resolve the crisis in Syria.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions from around the world on Islamic issues and Islamic principles. Like always, in our recent shows, we have invited Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools. We'd like to welcome him to this show and say salam to him and inshallah start our discussion with him. Sheikhuna, salam alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. It's a great pleasure for us. The question of the day that we want to pose it here and ask it from the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, is about the concept of the spell or talisman. And, you know, there are some ways to repel evil and badness from a community. It is quite famous among the common lay people that it is said, if you want to repel any evil from your life, from your community, from your family, you need to refer to this talisman or to this spell. What is being said in Latin, Arabic as talism. So we want to talk about the reality of these issues and concepts to see if they are real and we are allowed to refer to such things or not. Or if it is true, okay, we need to have more information. If it is not true, so what is the best way to repel and refrain from badness and the evil that comes to a person's life? Sometimes life of a person is full of evil or, let's say, bad luck. And it is being said that, oh, there is some, let's say, supplication or prayer has been made on you. And you need to break that, let's say, that borders and lines which have surrounded you. Is it true, Sheikh, first? And then tell us about the reality of talisman or these spells and tell us if they are real or not.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. You see that it is one of the questions that frequently has been asked, that whether we have this kind of spell or they have any kind of effect on the lifestyle of human being. When you look at the verses of Noble Quran and the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salatu was-salam, and before that when we check it with a reason and the rational power of human being, it is not, rationally speaking, acceptable to have to believe in any kind of effect of the, for example, some inanimate things to have on the life of the human being.
Yeah.
Rationally speaking, how it is possible that to believe that these talisman or a spell have any kind of effect on the life of human being?
Mm-hmm.
It is not acceptable. You see that when we check it with the reasoning power of human being, we cannot find any kind of validity for such a, you know, ideas and for such a inanimate, you know, matters.
True.
If when we go to the verses of Noble Quran and the narrations of Ahlul Bayt, pure progeny of Noble Prophet, we see that the emphasis is on, for example, prayer, which is dua, or a sadaqa, which is kind of charity. If you want to, for example, repel any kind of disaster or bala, which we call it. Of course, these kind of recommendations of Ahlul Bayt, it does not mean that all your power should be on, for example, prayer and charity. These are part of the, you know, factors and part of the elements which can affect your life. Because you know that the power of the choosing and power, willpower of human being, and how to plan for your future, all these matters, okay? But after all, we have power.